Hey everybody, welcome to episode 46 of It's Just Bodybuilding. Of course, Dusty Hanshaw and myself, Big Ron Parlow. And on today's episode, we thought we'd do something a little different. We're going to bring on a non-bodybuilding guest. I'm talking about none other than NFL veteran, played for the Packers, played for the Colts. Now he's a well-respected photographer and artist, Tony Mandrich on It's Just Bodybuilding.
I think that was better anyways. I think you did.
There you go.
That was a lot of pressure the second time.
A lot of pressure. That's okay. The pressure's what this guy had to deal with.
I feel good.
A lot of it. Remember, like, share, subscribe, comment. That's the four? Yeah, there you go. Yes. Help us out. It's all about the algorithms.
That's right. On all six of our episodes.
Yes.
46.
That was a good save, though.
I thought it was fantastic.
There we go.
We got to play both of these now. We'll do both intros. I think that'd be cool, back to back.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 6 of It's Just Bodybuilding. Episode 6. Scott's just dying. He loved
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he is. He's like, Jesus, fuck, stop it already.
God, thanks for everything, Scott. People don't realize how much bullshit he has to tweak a lot of the times. They
sure
think this just comes
with
easy.
Us.
Yeah, yeah.
I had someone ask me, actually, they're like, how's the podcast? Is it pretty simple? I'm like, yeah, I talk for 2 hours and I hang up. It's very simple. They're like, well, who uploads it? I'm like, well, Scott takes care of all that. I was like, I don't know.
I talked to someone else who has a podcast, and they were like, how long does it take you to like edit it? How many hours? And I was like, oh, well, there's three of us. And he was like, oh, I should have done that.
You think?
That's what, you know, because he's like doing everything himself, which is like, I guess if you have the time or if you have like, you know, some people want it to be exactly a certain way, maybe, or they like working on the stuff, but I don't know the software, you know?
No. That sounds like work.
I did have a podcast called Canadian Bodybuilding Radio back in like 2009, 2010.
Jesus.
And we did like 70 episodes. It's funny. I like forgot about it. Someone reminded me the other day, but it was really fun. And we had a lot of guests on. We had Chris Aceto on back then. We had Hani Rambod on. We had Chad Nichols on. Damn. We had like good guests and stuff, but I used to edit that. I used to use GarageBand, but that was like amateur hour, you know,
didn't quite look like ours.
No video either. So just, you know, I could just like,
Okay.
And there was like no rules, like, you know, it wasn't on, I don't even know what it was on. It was on iTunes, I think. But we were like taking chunks of like Metallica songs and dropping them on. Like there was no,
cannot do that anymore.
Yeah, there was none of that, right? So it was easy. But okay, so today, tell people what we're doing, Dusty.
I'm stoked because we're finally, you know, we talked about it, getting out of the bodybuilding world, but I consider Tony in the bodybuilding world because
yeah,
that's how we met. Actually, was he's psychotic in the gym.
Yeah, and he was 320 pounds when he was playing football. He's fucking
yeah.
Huge.
We're both very tall, so we had a lot in common. It's close. If you've seen the pictures, Scott, I'll send you a picture. If my hair was just a little longer, I think I got him. But so he actually hit me up from some of my training videos, and next thing you know, we were doing some filming, some training videos, some shoots, and it's been awesome. But then, of course, I had to go back and educate myself and realize, oh fuck, this is not a human I'm talking to.
No, very, very, very interesting story. We're very happy to have him on. Let's give him a call now, and bring him on. It's Just Bodybuilding. Good to have you on, Tony.
It's a pleasure.
Very happy to have you on. We've been looking forward to kind of branching out and having some different guests with some really interesting stories on. And when Dusty said that he thought he could get you to agree to this, I was pretty happy. So I know who you are. I remember when you got drafted, and I remember, you know, I actually, first thing I want to ask you, when Dusty told me you're coming on, I went and looked at some of your videos, And I forgot you were on David Letterman.
I thought you were going to say, I forgot how arrogant you were.
No, no.
No, we remember that. We're good.
No, because I still can be.
Yeah.
It's good. I was on Letterman. It was awesome because that was one of my favorite shows at the time.
Yeah. I'm a Letterman guy. I wasn't a Letterman guy. I watched Letterman my whole life.
I agree.
So what was that like? Like just, you know, I mean, were you hanging out backstage with anybody? Like what was it like to go to the Letterman show?
Yeah. You know, you wish, you know, hindsight, you wish they had other guests like, you know, some supermodel or something, but they had Penn and Teller, right? Of all the people, they had Penn and Teller. And I'm like, this is great, you know, but it was just the whole experience was really cool. And it's one of those moments, and I'm sure I know you guys have both experienced this feeling of you're there and you're like, fuck, is this shit really happening? Like, is this about to happen? You know, it's like, I've been watching this my whole life and now it's about like, I'm going to be there in the chair. So it was surreal. It was surreal. It was awesome. And you know what? I mean, you know, I met him before the show and talked to him once for 10 minutes during the show, and he's as down to earth and real as a guy, you know, in those 10 minutes, as I could say, he wasn't arrogant. He paid attention. He acknowledged. He wasn't one of those people that was like, okay, next, you know?
Right.
That's what I've always heard about Letterman. That's why he's so well respected. That's why he has the show he has now and gets those types of guests.
Yes.
You know? So let's go to the NFL, Dusty. We're going to start there.
Well, you know, first I wanted to actually go one step before that, which is, can you give some insight into what college life was like being who you were, not on the field, but just life in general, being in Michigan and like, you know, I mean, you stick out just a hair anyways. So I just wonder, like, what was like day to day? Like, I mean, did it even feel like you were in college or you were just busy being you?
You know, all the shit they right. say, were you actually having to study for stuff and like how much help were you getting and all that shit?
I mean, you know, listen, we got help. There's no doubt we got help in two different ways. One was we had all access to tutors. So like if we needed to study for something that just wasn't our forte, whether it was literature or math or chemistry, I didn't study, but I knew about.
That fell in there on accident.
We're all amateur chemists, Tony. Right. We're all amateur chemists.
That's why they call it a practice.
Yes.
So they gave us the resources. And then, you know, there's that old phrase of, you know, what courses are you taking this term? And, you know, it'd be like this, because they're mandatory in basket weaving, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there'd be the basket weaving course. I mean, I took coaching, football coaching 101, 102, and 103 over 3 years. And it's like, come on. It's like, how many people on the field at once on an offense? Right. 11. Pass.
Unless you're Canadian.
Right. And you have this ginormous field, right?
Yeah. And the guys are smaller.
Thank God I didn't play in Canada. I would have ran myself to death.
You would have had to play at 290.
Yeah. You're right.
So yeah. So what about the party life? Like, what was it like as a superstar in college?
You know, it was, this may surprise you. I went to college for two purposes. I always kept things very simple and very fundamental. And when things started going awry, I went back to fundamental because it always seemed to go back to fundamentals, because whatever you're doing and complicating is a distraction from why am I here? I would literally stand in front of my mirror in my dorm room and say, why the F are you here? When I started screwing up, because I'd be out partying. This was mostly my freshman year. I'd be out partying till 2-3 in the morning, you know, and waking up at 9 a.m. and it would screw my workout up. Like I'd work out, but I was like, I wasn't at max potential because I knew what I could do when I didn't party.
Right.
So, you know, kind of making a best practice decision, I was like, this is a distraction. So I still went out with the guys and would drink socially and have a couple beers, because that wouldn't affect really my next day. And I wouldn't stay out till 2 a.m. I'd come home 11 or 12. And that was totally my choice, because it was, for me, it was more important to get an education and to play and, you know, to get to the next level of football, which at college was the NFL then.
Yeah.
And even then, I broke those goals down even simpler and more fundamental. It was to become a starter, then to become All Big Ten, then to become All American, and to, you know, win Best Lineman of the Year, all that stuff, and then get drafted in the NFL. So there had to be a, you know, once A had to happen before B had to happen before C, because you couldn't just have, you know, all these things, you snap your fingers, you jump into the NFL. Mm-hmm. So the priority for me was, you know, go to school, get your education, because I was like, I might as well get my education while I'm here. And, but really, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. I mean, I was there to get to the next level.
Right.
And I picked Michigan State for very fundamental reasons. They had a new head coach who just came from the Pittsburgh Steelers, who had won 4 Super Bowls in 6 years in the 70s. So, you know, he was so, if anybody knew how to get there, or if anybody said after my third or fourth year, you know, look, shit ain't happening. You just don't have the ability, or you don't have the work ethic, or you don't have the luck, or whatever the case may be, he'd be the guy to say it.
Right.
You know, and that's what I wanted. And I needed an in-your-face guy, because now, you know, I don't need a participation ribbon guy. You know, mm-hmm. I need an in-your-face guy. Mm-hmm. But the party life, I mean, it was there, but it wasn't, it was more focused on, this is how, I'll let you in on my brilliance, okay?
Love it. Here we go. I got to grab my pen.
He needs all the advice.
You're recording this, right?
Go ahead.
I'm putting enough stress on my liver, bladder, heart, all these other parts of my organs, doing these other chemicals. Mm-hmm. That I don't need to add by adding alcohol, street drugs, and all that other stuff.
Right.
You know, and when I started doing those other chemicals, back in the day we would call it juice, I wasn't doing it right for about a year. And then I met a guy, which I don't want to say his name, but everybody knows his name, who was a freaking just... He was like, for me, he was like the Chris Aceto.
Right.
As far as chemicals go. And you know, he was very good with, you know, nutrition.
Yeah.
I've still got his workouts in a Duotang folder that are printed out on a dot matrix printer.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I've kept those for the archives.
Yeah. What years were you playing in Michigan?
That'd have been Michigan State.
Yeah, Michigan State. Yeah,
we don't want to confuse them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
You have to add the state, or it's a big problem. Oh,
yeah, that's a sin. Yeah. That's almost a sin.
Okay.
Strike
okay.
One. He hasn't hung up yet.
Right? No.
Yeah, hey, well, I knew that applied to Florida. I didn't realize that was a Michigan thing, too. So there you go.
I think it's interstate.
Yeah. Okay, so how many years were you there?
I was there 5 years. First year, I got redshirted. So I was there from 84, fall of 84. And I left there for second week or middle of like January of 89.
Okay. And then that's when you were on Letterman, right? You hadn't been drafted yet, had you?
I had been.
Oh, you had been. Okay.
I had been drafted. I had just been drafted. SI cover Packers. Came out in April. Yep. And a week later, the Packers or the NFL draft was, I got drafted by the Packers. And then the Letterman show ensued, like, you know, 2 weeks later. And remember Pat Sajak show?
Yeah.
The Wheel of Fortune. I was on his show. I thought that was kind of fun. I thought that was kind of cheesy even back then, you know. Here's a guy that's like, you know, talking about vowels and stuff. And I'm like on his show. it was just odd. It was fun.
So you were famous in college. Like, How famous were you in when you were in college before you got drafted? Like, would people recognize you everywhere? Because you were like on the news, and everyone knew who you were.
You're talking like my early years in college?
Well, I'm assuming it was later. I'm assuming that, you know, your last couple of years when you were
So, you know, first year redshirt, you don't play.
Yeah.
And then I started the next 4 years. But I didn't become an All-American until my fourth year there. Mm-hmm. And then was an All-American the last 2 years. So after that first year of being All-American, which was my fourth year in college, that's when it started to get noticed a lot. And I can honestly say it was more like there was more notoriety in the Big Ten and the media with football. But as you guys know, if you go walking around somewhere, because I want it to be freaky big. I want it to be creature big, right?
Yeah.
I want it to be so big it was like, what the fuck was that? That just walked by, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And you guys understand that. So that's what really drew a ton of attention.
Right.
And I was like, okay, it's working. And it wasn't like it's working, the attention's working. The way I'm working out, what I'm taking, how I'm sleeping, what I'm doing is working.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, because you still gotta be able to run.
Right. That's the tricky part that I was curious about, because I think that's where I get that a lot. Like, people will make comments about, you know, someone my size, like, oh man, I can't imagine you doing this or that, and it's athletic. And I always laugh because I'm like, oh, I can't do anything athletic. I'm completely useless as an athlete.
Like, well, you played hockey, literally, didn't you?
I did when I was smaller, though. I was 210, you know.
I'm smaller, you know, at 210, right?
I'm 300 now. Like, you know, I think carefully when I jump off like a high ledge with my dogs. I'm like, all right, let me look. All right, if I do this gracefully at 300 pounds, I might not break anything. But so what was your, you know, one thing I wanted to grab before we skipped on, you said with college, you kept going back to the basics, as far as your mindset and things like that. Did you find, cause this is the time I want for the people who are watching, is, was it the same with the training? Like, was it the basics? Was the intensity? I mean, what did you credit, overall, the things that made you able to get so big? Because, I mean, you were ahead of your time as far as being a freak and an athlete. I mean, they have that now, but I think that's why you were such a standout back then, is you were a freak, but it was functional.
Yeah, and I think another thing that brought a lot of attention to it was your media outlets, or your sports media outlets, were much fewer than they are now. So SI was like king. I mean, mm-hmm. Even if you were in SI, you were credibility right away. Mm-hmm. And because they're not going to write about stuff and that's just, you know, nonsense. I would say one of the things I always did was when I will refer to this, what I said earlier about fundamentals. I always made things tangible. And this actually started like when I was 11 years old, and it's true to this day today. I will always put things on paper. Mm-hmm. I'll write it out. I'll make bullet points. I'll make the goals, and I'll make like my short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. So short-term being 30 to 60 days, mid-term being, you know, 6 months, and then long-term being kind of like almost 5 years. Because if it's not working at 30 days or 30, 45 days, it's not going to work at, you know, the midpoint. You got to change something right now. Right.
Right.
So it was, I don't know why, but fundamentally it was always like, just if things aren't working right, start questioning. Mm-hmm. And that includes especially question yourself.
Right.
How many times have you guys sat in the gym after a kick-ass workout and, you know, you just kind of gather in your thoughts and you're thinking, yeah, that was awesome. But that inner voice inside you saying, did I really give it all I got?
Mm-hmm, right.
Did I really give it? And you could have had a freaking awesome workout and maybe set personal records. Mm-hmm. And then I would always ask myself, do I have anything left in the tank? And if I didn't have anything left in the tank, or a lot of times I'll say leave nothing on the plate, then I'm good. I can sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's, you know, that's true today, not as extreme. I think just because the older you get, you kind of, I mean, and it's not to be funny, but you get tired.
Right.
You know, you get tired and it's like hard to keep. I expect this level of performance in anything I do. Like that's right. What I expect out of myself, but it's exhausting.
Right.
You know, at 53, it's exhausting. And, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. It just, you need to pick and choose your, what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that essentially that voice that constantly questions if you have anything left is the kind of base of anyone who does something spectacular?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I think, you know what I mean? And the other name for the voice is the dark side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think everybody's got a dark side. The people that I feel bad for are the people that deny it.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like, come on, man. I mean, it's like everybody's got the taboo deep down inside of them that they don't want anybody to know or talk about. And it's like, it's okay. Just as long as that vice doesn't, or as long as it doesn't become a vice, you know, switch it into that virtue. And for me, you know, later on in life, that did become a vice. And with my drinking and painkiller abuse and, you know, all that drug abuse, and almost killed me. And then I got sober and then turned it into the virtue of shit. You know, I thought getting sober was impossible for me. I was like, because I tried hundreds of different ways and I couldn't do it. And I had, you know, just like you guys, the willpower of a freaking bull.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, let's get this done. Okay. Let's grab the bull by the horns and pull that fucker.
Yeah.
Right. I couldn't do it, man. I tried so many times and I got my ass kicked.
What do you think made you, I mean, what was the click or what did you do different that puts you over that edge that you did do it?
When it started to take control of my life, fear and lack of like a foundation, like who I'm surrounding myself with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think that pressure makes you an alcoholic or a drug addict. And when I refer to alcoholic, I mean some kind of abuse of chemical. And chemical, it could be food. I mean, it could be an overeater. It could be anything. Right. Anything that makes your life unmanageable, where you're not starting to come home to your family, or you're not starting to come show up for work, or you're starting to skip workouts. Hey, I can do three a week. I'm good, Chris. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Deal with that one.
You know? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he'll laugh at you. But it's like, my feeling is, and it's not my theory because it's kind of been proven, you know, alcoholism is a disease. Like it's literally a disease, no different than cancer.
Mm-hmm.
When I got sober 25 years ago, it was still looked at. It was still a disease by the treatment centers and the medical community and a lot of the community. But there was a lot of people that were like, it's a moral thing. Pull up your bootstraps and suck it up. Right.
Yeah. They sort of quit being a bad person.
Right. Yeah. Grow up and be a man. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, you know, and this is after all the shit, you know, that you do in the weight room and you're slinging.
Yeah. It's like, you know who you're talking to?
Weight around. Right. And it's like, and I'm like, I've got this. I can do this. I can do this. And then once I went 14 days without drinking and drugging, right. By choice. I was like, I am so sick and tired of my bullshit. Right. I was like, I got to stop this. So I stopped for 14 days. But that disease, that voice in your head says, see, you don't have it. You just went 14 days.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, you're right. So I start.
So you go back.
Yeah. I start chipping again. I'm like, but I'll control it this time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And then a month later, it's like back to 80 pills a day and, you know, whatever the drink of choice was.
When you, because I know you did, you had what, 4 years with the Packers, correct?
Yes.
And then you had a break, like three or four years.
Three, 4 years out of the league, yep.
And then when you came back, were you clean at that point?
Yes. Yes, nice. I was 100% clean. And when I left treatment, I went in March 23rd of 95 to a treatment center in Detroit voluntarily. And was in there 17 days, did everything that they had suggested. Because I was like, for once, And actually, I'll tell you the line that made me really was the Louisville slugger over the face. Mm-hmm. We were in this room with a counselor in this treatment center in Brighton, Michigan, which is right outside of Detroit. And there's nine of us inpatient people, and it holds like 30. And mm-hmm. it's like a dormitory slash hospital. It's nothing fancy.
Yeah.
And this lady's graciously says, okay, so like before we start the meeting, she goes, I just want everybody to sit for a second and think about this. Your greatest plans and the plans that you had for building your empire got you here in this treatment center in Detroit. And I was like, oh my God, she's right.
That's great, especially for you. Like, yes, that's
right.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my gosh, that was the Louisville slugger. And it was kind of like from that day on, I was like, you know what? I don't have all the answers.
Right.
I don't. And because before that, I had the answers for me and for you.
Right.
Like how you should live your life and how I should live mine. Now it's like, you know, it's really there was a huge paradigm shift then mm-hmm. of being a lot more, you know, open-minded to, and accepting of a lot of things that I just was really had a hard stance on.
Right.
As far as I'm aware, the drugs and the drinking started pretty much as soon as you got to Green Bay.
Like the street drugs, if you will, or the pharmaceutical, painkillers.
Painkillers.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I meant.
There was some use of that my last year of college. But it was like it was in no way in an abusive way.
Right.
It was taken as needed, as it should have been taken.
Like you took a couple of pills that year for certain aches and pains.
Or the next day after the game, you know, because you can barely walk. And you're 21 years old, you can barely walk because you're so beat up.
Right.
Fuck. So when you get to Green Bay, what was you're drafted now. So are you thinking like, okay, like it's Super Bowl time. I gotta, you know, I'm gonna win a Super Bowl now. Like, is that what you're thinking?
Well, I'll tell you what, draft day was probably one of the biggest letdowns of my life.
I knew you didn't want to go to Green Bay, right?
And it wasn't because of that. You know, a lot of people will think that it wasn't like, and I vocally said it so many times, right? I mean, I didn't want to go to Green Bay, and I said Green Bay's a village. And then I was like, oh, you know, shit, these people like took that personally. So then I said, every village needs an idiot. So then I kind of made up with it. But because they're proud people and they're great people. They're proud Midwestern blue collar people. And that's what my parents are, you know, coming from Southern Ontario. And on draft day, I was in Green Bay. I was with my brother, and I even have a picture of it. It's framed. And we're standing in the stands, an empty Lambeau Field. And there's a picture taken by the photographer. And it was great. Like, because him and I, like, this was like the dream, right? For both of us to play in the NFL. He played college. He played at Edmonton for 9 years, I think, and then went to Ottawa for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But the dream came true. And that was really almost the first time I realized. And because I really questioned myself, is it because it's Green Bay? And it wasn't because it was Green Bay. It's like I enjoy the process of getting there much more than the arrival of getting there.
Right.
So even the Rose Bowl, it's like that whole season was freaking awesome and crushing it and everything. And then you get to the Rose Bowl and like as a kid, you grow up and you go, this is like the granddaddy of them all. And that's when the Rose Bowl was like really like the biggest game of them all.
Right
now, it's just one of the, you know, whichever game they or bowl game they choose. And I was like, you know what? It's not what I expected. It was, I don't want to say it was a letdown, but it wasn't what I expected. And again, that's, you know, my perceptions on what I perceived on how it would be.
Right.
But I really noticed it when I got drafted. You know, it's like, and you think about it, if you're the second player taken in the draft, there's only one of those a year.
Right.
And, you know, so it's like, you know, and I was grateful, even though, you know, I was talking smack to build up media attention because I was an offensive lineman. We just don't get media attention.
Yeah.
So, and I was using it as a leverage thing for negotiating. And,
yeah. You helped build yourself as a badass.
Yeah.
You were branding.
Exactly. And but I was like, I remember sitting there with my brother in the stands going, this is it. Like, this is what, like, I'm 21 years old. At 11, I put the pencil to the paper.
Right. So 10 years.
10 years. And that's quick.
Yeah, hell yeah, it is.
So, you know, you look at a, you next time you run across an 11-year-old that makes a career decision, you'll see how, you'll get reminded on how young that person is, right?
Yeah,
and they
exactly.
make a career decision. So I was like, you know, and this is a little warped, but I know you guys will relate. It's, yeah. it's
we're warped. This is right. fun.
Right. Exactly what we're
so
talking
we
about.
We always jive, right? So it's like at 11, I pull out a piece of paper, a pad of paper with a pencil, and I start writing, okay, I want to play for the Philadelphia Eagles, and I want to, everything I do from here on out, that's a major decision. If it's a if it's a distraction, I'm going to have to ask myself, does this help me towards my next goal for the really big goal in 10 years?
Right.
And if it was a distraction, I would remove it. Or I would remove myself from it.
Right.
And it wasn't like every single decision, but it was anything that was kind of semi-major. You know, I was already hitting the weight room, but I was also reminded by my brother and some other people that, like, look, you're 11 years old. You shouldn't be you know, you shouldn't be lifting too much weight. Do the plyometrics, do the push-ups, do the pull-ups, you know, run, do all this. So I did.
Hey, what's up, guys? Scott McNally here, and we're gonna jump to a quick commercial break. So I promise that I'll be brief with this. So this week, we have 5 podcasts coming out. Between the new improved drugs and stuff, we have our Road to North Americans. Of course, Ron and Dusty are back. And then we have Dr. Scott Stevenson laying down some sick knowledge about HIIT training. And we have our new show, Renegade Muscle, with the one and only Lee Priest, along with Jeff Roberts. You know, I'm recording every single one of these programs. I do all the editing, the art, the MP3, the YouTube. And, you know, and it takes a lot of time. I'm not complaining because this is definitely a labor of love. I'm living my best life through this. But the only way I can make that work is by somehow getting paid in the process. And that's where our advertisers come in. So, guys, if you enjoy the shows, then I encourage you to shop with our advertisers, because I put these advertisers together with our programs because I believe in them, A, and B, because they're companies that make sense, you know, for us. TrueNutrition.com has some of the greatest supplements that are out there for some fantastic prices. I absolutely believe in them. And they basically carry everything that a bodybuilder could use, from health supplements to performance supplements and a lot more. They have basically every protein under the sun, every flavor that you could think of. They have it all for reasonable prices. So check them out, TrueNutrition.com, and you could use our code ADVICES. And then you could check out GetAzoth.com, where we also have a link to their Amazon. Both of those, you can use the code ADVICES10, and they have some of the best nootropics that are available out on the market. If you're looking to like up your edge in life, those things can definitely help. They're fun to experiment, and it's fun to see, you know, like basically just, well, I use them with my podcasting, and I definitely know that I've gotten an edge. So you can get an edge anywhere, be it in work or the gym or a long road trip, whatever it may be. But like I said, I've paired with the advertisers that I believe in, and advertisers that make sense to us. So if you enjoy our programming and that these are the types of products that you would buy anyway, then please consider shopping with our sponsors and using our codes, because that allows me to continue to put these podcasts out. All right, guys, thanks for listening to me. I appreciate it. We've got links in the show notes. Let's get back to the program.
Right.
You know, I listened and I did. And then, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you guys are old enough to remember when high school had like machine shop.
Oh yeah.
And stuff. So we would build our equipment.
Awesome.
Like back pull down stuff.
Yeah.
And we put it in my buddy's basement of his parents' house, and it was a dirt floor. Okay. And it was like, cause after we saw Pumping Iron, we were like, this is the shit. It's like, this is so cool. And then after we saw Rocky, like those were two movies that really like impacted me. And they were like, one came out, I think, in 76, one came out in 77.
Yeah.
So it was like about that age where I started to make that decision. And it was like in Rocky, you start to see it doesn't have to be fancy.
Yeah.
You know, and what does that all come back to? fundamentals.
Yep, for sure.
It doesn't have to be shiny. It's like Dust, like when I asked Dusty, this was before COVID really hit. There was a new gym opening up on the north side of Scottsdale, same company at the gym that he works out at, but it's like 5-6 miles away. But that gym's way more like grungy, hardcore, and Dusty, yeah, you know, adds to that, to say the least.
They let me play there.
Right. <Yeah. laughs> And, but this one is more like a really nice club.
Right.
So, and it's like a mile from me. So I'm like, hey, you know, Dusty, I texted him. I was talking about some new supplement products, nutrition for meal replacements and stuff. And I said, hey, are you going to check out this new one? And he's like, no, I'm going to let all the nice, fancy, I won't say Scottsdale people, but the nice, fancy people go up there so they can leave me alone and let me lift here.
Yeah.
I was laughing my ass off.
It was all part of the master plan.
Right. The distraction was leaving where he was at, you know?
Yeah, he's making life easier for himself.
Exactly. So, you know, tangibility, fundamentals, things on paper for me are very important because there's something you can touch and feel. I won't put it on a phone.
Right.
Because it's, even though it's tangible, it's digital, you can hold a phone and everything, but there's something about a piece of paper and a pencil or a pen.
A piece of paper stays on
it.
Yeah.
Your own handwriting. That's supposed to be like, exactly, literally it's different to your brain.
Exactly.
Because you can recognize it that way. Did you, because you said you did that at 11, and I'm fascinated with that because I have some friends with kids that have really big goals. And I mean, I'm aging myself, but when I had big goals at 12 years old, it was like a decision.
Yeah. Like
nothing else mattered. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
exactly what you're exactly.
Did someone teach you that stuff, or did it just come to you when you were a kid and you knew, like, well, if I'm going to get somewhere, I need to have a map? I mean, is that something you did yourself or what?
You know, nobody taught me to do it the way I did it, like the writing it on paper. But as I got older and reflected back on life, and I reflect back on life a lot to see where the lessons were and where they are, and is my parents were immigrants. Mm-hmm. So they escaped Eastern Europe out of communism when they were 21. They were crossing a river where the water was up to their necks, holding a small suitcase over their head. That's all they had. And going to another country that wasn't communist and stayed in a refugee camp for 6 months until they had their background checks to make sure they weren't like criminals before they were sent to the Western world. And it, for them, it happened to be Canada because they already had people there. So I think just that story in itself was powerful for me. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom would always tell a story of, she was in third grade, and this is former Yugoslavia, which is now, you know, broke up into five countries, and they were from Croatia. But she said her mom walked into class, and this, you got to think Eastern Europe, this is like 1940s, mid to late 40s after World War II.
Right.
Her mom walks into her third grade class, talks to the teacher. And the teacher calls her up and says, you know, go with your mom. So her mom pulls her out of class and she goes, okay, the guy that we hired to tend to the sheep, our sheep that we own in the mountains, bailed on us. So I need you to take care of the sheep. Here's a staff, a wooden staff to keep the wolves away from them.
Now go.
Right. And you know what she did? She was like, all right, business, like, you know, that's just what you do.
Right.
And yeah, she's a girl and she's in third grade.
Yep.
So even though it was never said, hey, put your stuff on paper and stuff, it was like those examples and those stories really like resonated with me, like, because I was like complaining about not having enough or not having the coolest football gear in high school or whatever and then I thought to myself, man, it's like I don't have any problems. Yeah. You know, the stuff that they went through. And even I even used like that specific story. I would think about laying, like when we were in camp in Indianapolis at football camp, and it's hot and humid in Indy in summer. Mm-hmm. And you're in full pads and you're second practice of the day. And you'd be halfway through stretch and my forearms would be just beaded up with sweat. Right. And you know, you've got an hour and a half of pretty much, full speed, stop, full speed, stop. And I'd lay there and be like, feeling sorry for myself. And then that story would pop into my head and I'd be like, okay, you're getting paid seven figures.
Right.
You know, you're doing a job you absolutely love.
Yeah.
And you're feeling sorry for yourself. And I'm telling you what, in a snap, it changes your perspective inside to become grateful. Mm-hmm. And then really to, to perform as well as you can in practice.
I think that execution changes when how you look at it changes. I had a guy ask that just yesterday on my Q&A. How do you handle your mood swings when you're in prep and dieting?
What's
and
a mood swing?
I just answered that. I said, it's simple. You get to choose this. You're fortunate to get to do this.
Yeah.
Stop being a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's really that easy. Cause when you look at it, it's like, we have unlimited. I mean, I can have any food I want.
Right.
I'm choosing to eat this way. How are you going to be an asshole based on a choice that you want? And kind of same with you. You're like, wait a minute, this is everything I've ever wanted. Like, yeah, it's difficult.
Right.
But it's fucking awesome. I mean, especially you. Yeah. Like, I mean, I can't help but be like, you walk away from, I tell people all the time, like with bodybuilding, guys are like, oh, well, they retire and then they come back 2 years later. I'm like, he's done. You don't get to leave and come back.
Yeah.
Like, how did you left the NFL and then came back and made real money in a real team? Like,
and played really well.
Yeah. What did you do? I mean, what happened when you decided, all right, fuck it, I'm going back to the NFL? I mean, and you were clean now, and you were drug clean, and you were probably relatively juice clean. I mean, what'd you do?
Oh, I mean, absolutely juice clean.
You had nothing. You just went back and said, I'm
going to go. I had the old creatine that you had to load and shit yourself the second day, right?
So what did you do? I mean, how did you approach that training? I mean, that's something that blows my mind. Because like I said, I mean, when guys walk away, I'm usually like, oh, well, you're done.
Right. Right.
What did you do?
And that's pretty much true what you said. And that's like pretty much true at any high level of sport.
Right.
And I was out 3 years and so now you've kind of know how I think.
Right.
And go ahead.
Not to interrupt you. Of the 3 years that you were out, I remember hearing that you drank and did drugs for two of them.
Two and a half of them. Yeah. Two and a half. Yeah.
So your comeback to the NFL was actually
I was 11 months sober.
Okay. Wow. So this changes the story a little bit.
Yeah. We lost sober. A couple of years.
You weren't working out the whole time.
It was a blur. It was blurry. Watching OJ's Bronco go down the highway on TV was blurry.
Wow. At least you had something to watch.
Right.
Trial of the century.
It was, you know, what I'd mentioned earlier. So even before the drugs took me and took over my life and my life became unmanageable, you knew how I like fundamentally was wired, like structure and plan and execute. And then that takes over and just derails me. Right. And then I go, okay, what do you do when you get derailed? You go back to fundamentals.
Right.
So that's when the 14 days of getting clean happened. And then that voice inside your head says, see, you're clean. Right. And then I'm like, yeah, I am clean. So I can go back to drugs. So I can do my pray. So that's the disease part of it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a physical, reaction and a mental obsession. Mm-hmm. And once you add alcohol to that whole thing, it becomes a train wreck.
Right.
So you guys know how much willpower you have. So think about, like, you're getting your ass kicked by something that you just cannot do.
Right.
Yet you can lift the world, right? And you can do reps of this, and you can, I mean, I watch Dusty on Instagram. I live vicariously through him. He doesn't know it, but when he does deadlifts and then bent over rows with like 500 plus pounds, I'm like, that fucker, you know?
Everyone does like, that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, but it's like, man, that's fucking, I'm like, that's cool as shit. Cause not everybody can even come close to that.
Yeah,
They can try, but they can't, They just can't do it because they don't give themselves, a lot of them don't give themselves permission to.
How did you get Indy to give you a chance? What's that story? Like, did you make a call and go, listen, I'm sober for a month now? Like, what happened?
So I left treatment. I went into treatment March 23rd, 95, 17 days later, I left treatment and I had no intention of going back to play. I mean, I was going to be happy with, I just want a normal life, and which is kind of funny when I think back about it, because I want nothing to do with normal. Yeah. And you know, it's like, I don't want nothing to do with average or normal. And I say that not in an arrogant way. I just say it in a way of, this is how I want to live my life. I want to live it all out, full out, full speed.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and do the best that I can do and be the best that I can be. And there are people that are happy with 9 to 5, and there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work for me.
Right.
So when I leave treatment, I have a mullet. Okay. My skin is got a shade of yellow from jaundice and just because of my liver's all messed up from 90 painkillers a day. And I had done, you know, steroids since 80, January 89.
So you're juice free for 5-6 years.
Yeah.
What you were taking opiates? So were you using oxys and all that?
No, oxys weren't even out yet.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, oxys weren't even out. I was just using like Percodan, Percocet, and then anything else anybody had.
So morphine, any opiate would do.
Yes. Yeah. And I would usually, if I did morphine, I didn't want to do it in an injectable because it would really just kind of like make you too sleepy. Mm-hmm. I would do it in a pill form. And it's like, I had the whole science of it down on how much to eat, but don't eat too much because you want the full effect, but you don't want this. And it was like a job being a drug addict.
Right.
You know, it was crazy. So I called my agent at 6 months, or I should say, right before I left treatment, I met with that counselor again that talked about everybody's thinking, getting them in here. So I had a one-on-one meeting with her, and she's like, okay, we have to have a plan. So when you get out, there's a maintenance program on staying sober. And I said, okay. So one of the things she had mentioned, she goes, I know that, you know, you were an athlete and you played here at Michigan State and you played pro football. So it's not going to hurt your sobriety if you start working out once or twice a week or doing some kind of physical activity, fitness, jogging, hiking, doesn't matter what it is, because when you physically feel better, like you get in better shape, it's going to help your psyche.
Right.
And that's true. But what I heard was work out like a maniac 7 days a week.
Right.
Right. And that's what I did. So I went from like 255 to 305 in 6 months with no drugs.
Right.
And I didn't think it was possible. And I got to within 20% of my strongest ever.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like 6 months sober, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's like I'm getting plenty of sleep. I'm doing all these things that you're supposed to do, right? Give yourself the best chance. And so then I thought, you know, I did so many things that where I wronged the NFL and I wronged the fans and the media and just a lot of people in general in that like spectrum of the NFL and that genre. And I was like, I need to make things right, or as, because some things you just can't make right.
Right.
But I need to make right as much as I possibly can. Right. So I thought if somebody does give me a chance, you know, and if they do sign me, I'll come back and I'll keep my mouth shut and I'll work my ass off and earn my money and give that organization, whichever organization that was, everything I got.
Right.
And so I worked out, I worked out for Philadelphia, believe it or not. I worked out for Philadelphia in 1995. It was December. December of 95, I drove from Traverse City, Michigan to Cleveland, Ohio, which was an 8-hour drive in December. So think about this perspective. That was December of 95. In March of 90, I mean, in March of 89, I held my own combine at Michigan State.
Right.
And I had 28 teams come to Michigan State to watch me
come to watch you, right?
And you know,
you come
and,
to me,
right? Exactly, because you're, you know, if you're in one of those positions where you're projected to be a top five pick, you really get a lot of leverage to do stuff like that. So I went, you know, from the physical standpoint of testing and checking out all your joints, your orthopedic stuff, I did go to Indianapolis because that's where it is every year, the combine, and did all that. But I told them, I said, I'm not going to do any testing as far as running or lifting for three more weeks until you guys come to Michigan State. And basically what I was doing was I was buying myself more time to prepare.
Right.
And so I, so then they all came to Michigan State, and I was like, just, I mean, I was jacked up at 308. I was 308 and I looked like I was 350. Right. Because you know how that works. Yeah. Like, you know, the more harder you get, right? And I had a tank, I'll say it, a wife beater on. Okay.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You say that, you might get freaking protests.
No,
right?
Everyone knows
what
wife beater,
right?
Our show
is you whatever the fuck you want.
Right. Whatever, right? So I had a wife beater on and just some cutoff football pants. And I ran a 40. I ran a 40 in like 4.68 at 308. Right. And there was like 10, 15 guys on one side, and there was like a 10-yard gap at the 40-yard line, then 10, 15 guys on the other side, and they're all holding those digital, like, stopwatches.
Yeah.
Right. So they all hold them, and I run it, and they click it, and they look at it, and they all hold it to their chest because they all think they fucked up. Like, they pressed it too soon, right? And then they're like, what'd you get? And they were like, fuck, you really did run like a sub 4.7.
Right.
And so they averaged them all out and they said, you know, 4.68. And I said, okay. And you get to run two.
Right.
So I said, okay. And then the next one I ran a 4.64. And again, they did the same thing, but then they were more like, okay, this is kind of true. Yeah. So what kind of an asshole says something like this? Me. I turn around and I say, what did it end up being? They say 4.64. And I go, I can run one more if you want me to run a 4.5.
I love it. I love that shit.
I was like, you know, and I was like, said it so casually, nonchalant, right? And, you know, I think about that now and I'm thinking, if somebody would have said that to me, I'd be like, what a fucking prick, you know?
That's funny.
I'm the only one on this. It's like, right. Yes.
Yeah, but I still, there's a part of me that still appreciates it because it's, you know, it's kind of like the headspace you almost have to be in.
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. Like, it's, if you don't ever go to that sort of space where you lose a little bit of your,
it's a dark
reality.
Side. It's a dark
side. Yeah, it's a dark side.
It's a dark side that works for, you know, you try to harness it and make it work for you and benefit you.
It's only arrogance if you're wrong.
Exactly. Otherwise, it's confidence.
That's what I always say. Like, it's only arrogance if you're wrong. I mean,
there's a certain amount of your dark side that can be dealt with humor too.
Yes.
So when you do stuff like that, you know you're kind of being a dick, but it's funny.
Yeah.
A little smile, but I am serious.
Right.
So after that performance, did Indy like offer you a contract? Is that
So I'm just taking it back. I just showed you. I'm like took you back to the analogy of 6 years prior. I held my own combine.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm making a comeback, and I'm driving on my own dime 8 hours to Cleveland to get a workout with a scout that's flying through Cleveland and has a 6-hour layover.
Yeah.
So I'm in a community college basketball gymnasium doing a workout.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't run the 40 because there's not enough room, but I can do all the offensive line drills.
Yeah.
And this guy's like, where the hell have you been? And I said, well, you know, I got, you know, I told him in real general short form, I had a drug problem and have been sober now, you know, almost 11 months. And he's like, okay, well, I'm going to report back to Coach Ray Rhodes, who was the head coach there, who was one of the coaches at Green Bay when I left Green Bay. And they called me up and they said, can you fly out next week? And I said, yeah. And they said, okay, we'll call you Monday and to make arrangements. Well, it wasn't even an hour later. The community is small, right? Just like bodybuilding community is small and like word gets out and stuff. So Indianapolis had heard that I had a good workout. Right. And they called me up and they said, hey, we would like to fly you down for a workout. And I thought to myself, whoa, I just went from fucking driving 8 hours to now I've got a flight.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy shit. Like, this is awesome. Like, this is like, you know, I'm trying to keep my cool and not show them all of my excitement to them. And I said, sure. You know, like, when are you thinking, like, you know, next week or the week after? They're like, no, tomorrow morning. And I was like,
race.
I was like, yes, sir, I'll be there. Right. So I got there and had a great workout, and I ended up running a 4.7 something, which surprised the hell out of me, because, you know, it's like, you know, your feet go, even though it's 28 years old, your feet still will start to lose.
So all that, and you lost a 10th of a second,
But here's where the dark side comes in. And I'm not embellishing this at all when I say this. For 6 months of my sobriety before I got that workout, I played racquetball every single day for 7 days a week for six straight months. So, because I knew I needed to get those fast twitch muscles to push, to pull, to back up, to move forward, to, you know, hand-eye coordination, all that stuff. And I was like, racquetball is kind of like almost like the perfect thing to do that. So every day for 6 months, and I didn't miss one day, I played racquetball to get my foot speed back. And it did come back a lot, but it still wasn't even close to what it needed to be.
Right.
Because it's just, you're out of the game. I mean, that game is played just like your guys' sport. I mean, at the highest level, like, those guys don't get out of shape. Those guys and girls that are at the highest level, they just stay in shape the whole year. They're not peeled the whole year, but they stay in shape.
Yeah.
They don't blow up and stuff. So I did my workout and I had a flight leaving. I was like, fly in the morning, fly out that night. And I showered. I had my clothes on. I was in the locker room. It was February, because it was, you know, off season. Mm-hmm. And the scout comes around the corner and says, he was one of my like contact people. He says, he's got this like long thing, a contract that looks like one of those car contracts. It's like super long on legal paper, right? He's like, we want to sign you to a 2-year deal, first year minimum wage for a 4-year player, which was 196. And then the second year for 500,000. And it's like, you've seen the movie Matrix, right? Mm-hmm. When everything fucking just slows down.
Right.
And I was like, okay, this is 11 months. And 11 months prior, and I'm not embellishing at all, I was showering once a week. I couldn't get off the couch because I was so lazy, and I was just a despicable drug addict.
Right.
I was like a piece of shit. You know, that's how I was living. That's how I felt. I was like self-loathing, and it was everybody's fault but mine. Right. And then, you know, sobriety happens, something I thought was impossible for me. Right. And then 11 months later, I'm employable again. And not only am I employable, but I'm back in the arena that I freaking did the most harm to.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, like, it's definitely, you know, for me, whether you want to call it an act of providence, an act of God, a miracle, doesn't matter what you call it. For me, it was like a miracle that it happened. And I just wanted to make, it came with the motivation of, I wanted to make as much right as I could.
Right.
And here's an opportunity. And I took it. And ended up starting halfway through that first year, played, and then started the second year, and then started three quarters of the third year, and ended up breaking a facet in my back with like 5 games left. So I was done for that year. And then little did I know that was it. That was the end of it, because my shoulder was going to have off season shoulder surgery that off season. And they went in to, you know, scope it and stuff. And like, you know, like when you go into surgery and then you wake up and you go, well, what are we going to do surgery? Right. And it's like, you've been in there 4 hours and stuff because the anesthesia just messes you up.
Seconds,
Right. Exactly. So I was literally in surgery 5 minutes. They went in with a scope and they were like, there's nothing there. Like the bone that goes over your shoulder bone, like all this bone has been recessed back to here. It's all like being grinded out.
Right.
And I'm like, well, how does that happen? And then I started thinking, well, if you're doing power pulls with 315 and 405 and then letting it down and bringing it up and letting it down and shoulder press. And I'm like, oh, that's how that happens.
Yeah. They didn't know how it happened, but you knew.
Right. Right. So, but the great thing for me was in those 3 years, I felt that I did make things as right as I could make them.
Right. You played with dignity.
Exactly. And then I was like, you know what? It's time to move on. And the trainer, and they all knew my story about, because I was honest with them before I even signed. I said, look, I went through treatment by my, you know, nobody made me go. I went, and I've been sober 11 months. And I said, I literally used this phrase to them. I said, you're getting damaged goods. I said, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't want you to hear it from anybody else. Just so you know. So you don't say, why didn't you come back and tell me that you went through treatment? Right. So, and they still signed me.
Right.
So, you know, again, it's like one of those, another, like one of those, what I call God shots of like, man, it's like the hell. I mean, I let a lot of these people down and then wrong, not just let them down, but like insulted them.
Right.
And
did you ever run out of Green Bay money or did you always have some left?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had like a couple, I had like maybe 200,000 left when I got treatment, when I got out of treatment.
Right. Okay.
A lot of it, I'd say half of it. Okay. So, you know, you guys know this, a lot of people don't know this. So I was the first O lineman to make $1 million a year and I never even stepped on the field yet.
Yeah. So, you drafted at that, right? That was your contract. Right. Yeah.
So that opened the door finally for offensive linemen to make seven figures.
Right.
You know, so like the next year, 29 of them made over seven figures that deserved it, that were all pros already and stuff for years.
Right.
So I felt good about that. But I thought, damn, what was the part of your question that you're asking?
I just said, like, I didn't know if you'd run out of Green Bay money.
Yeah. So a lot of people think, okay, 4.4 million is really not 4.4 million.
Right.
Because
are you talking about the 4 years in Green Bay? Like four years?
Yes. Okay. So is because there's taxes involved.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you can take that down.
So now
to
you're 60, at 2.6.
Right. Exactly. Right. So that's still a lot of money. Right.
Yeah.
But inflation hasn't gone up that much since then. It's 30 years ago or whatever. But yeah, I blew through probably half that money on nonsense that I didn't need to really blow it on. I mean, it was cool stuff, but it wasn't like necessary.
Right.
And then the other half, you know, I put into some investments that I later pulled out when I ran out of this money.
Right.
But when I got sober, I was like at about 200 grand, you know, But here was a scary thing. It's like I was unemployable.
Right.
Yeah.
200 grand and nowhere to go.
Right. I couldn't have worked at a 7-Eleven because I wouldn't have showed up. I was so unreliable because I was because of the drugs.
Yep.
So, you know, it was. So I consider that. Yeah. You ran out of money.
Yeah.
You know, but that wasn't the motivator to get sober. The motivator was the pain, the emotional pain.
Mm hmm.
You know, I got sick and tired of my own bullshit.
Yeah, it's crazy.
If we go back, there was one thing about college that we touched on a bit, but you were kind of the first college player, well, the first one I remember, where there was like buzz about like, oh, he's on steroids and that sort of stuff. What was actually going on? Were you actually ahead of your time? Like, or was everyone kind of dabbling at that point already? Or were you kind of the only guy at that point? Like, how was it working?
There was a lot of people doing it.
Yeah.
We were doing it the correct way.
Right.
And we were doing it like, so I was getting my information from my guy.
Right.
Who was telling me what to take, knowing my whole goal, right?
Yeah,
right.
And his theory was multiple steroids at very, very low doses. And then he would change them up at certain times of the cycle and he would tell you why.
Right.
Which would make total sense, right? Mm-hmm. And because I always wanted to know, why are we changing this? Because it's working so well. And he's like, well, because your receptors are doing this. And he'd get into all the shit. I'd just be like, okay, that's enough. You know,
like you said, you didn't pass chemistry.
Right. So, I think I don't want to say we, but yeah, the information I got was like really good. So I think he was ahead of the game. Right. And I don't think he was the only one that had that information. I think other people had it, but they were more in the bodybuilding community.
Right. So a lot of guys were using juice. So was Mitty.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say 40% of the whole Big Ten was using juice.
So right. Did that ever bother you that you were the one getting asked?
No, you know why? Because you're a freak. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like, why are they asking me?
Yeah, you felt like that meant your shit was working better. It's
right.
What I'm doing is better. Right. Yeah.
It's like, that's the acid test. Why are you asking me? That guy's big too, right? Yeah. It's like, well, they're asking me because I think one of the main reasons is we're doing it in the most efficient way. I can't say that to the media, right? Yeah. We're doing it the most efficient way. We're being taught how, I'm sorry, I'm being taught how to do it. And because I was like, yeah, 5 cc's a test. Yeah. Do some Winstrol, do this. And I'm like thinking, what's the dose? I don't know. This looks good. You know, it's like, no, it's not a good plan.
Yeah. This guy helped you a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
This guy helped me a ton. He like took my dosages like way back. And I was like, I'm not going to get strong. He's like, listen, just if you work the way you say you work, you're going to get strong. So, and again, I was there to leave nothing on the table. I was like, if I don't make it, it's going to be okay because it won't be because of a lack of effort.
Right.
And that's why when we talked about earlier, I was like, this drinking partying is nice and it's fun. And I think everybody should have a good time in college. But I was like, you know what? My goal to me was more important than my partying.
Right.
At that time.
So the years go by and you find out that you're an artist. Did you always know that you, I mean, I think you said somewhere that you always considered yourself an amateur photographer. Is that not true?
Yeah. Or a serious hobbyist, like a serious hobbyist. Yeah.
That's what I read.
And then as I look back at my life, like I start to notice things, like things pop up and I go, well, that's a creative thing to do that most people wouldn't do. So when I played in high school, like high school football in Canada, you know, is like, it's so, I don't even know what to call it because I don't want to.
We don't have stadiums at our high schools.
No, no, we had bleachers.
Yeah, right? Bleachers. Yeah.
And it's that like held like 12 like people. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, my senior year of high school, I went to Ohio and they had a stadium of 12,000 for high school. But initial question.
How did you become the artist?
Like, how did I become the artist? So I would take my helmet home, which was a suspension helmet. So like a construction worker's, like the inside of a construction worker's
thing.
Right. It didn't have padding. It just had like So that's why you keep saying why? What was that question again? Because I got hit in the head too many times doing that. So I would sand that helmet down and paint the helmet the color of the school color, and I'll take the cage off the helmet and paint it the color it was. And if you think about that, that's a creative thing to do.
Yeah,
because I wanted it to look cool,
right?
And you know, so I almost wanted, like, I almost default back to way back when I was in high school, even though I hated going to art class and or music class, which was mandatory in those things. I was like, I want nothing to do with this. But it was like I was doing things that were creative that were, you know, I didn't realize till many years later in life. Even the lifting, especially with what you guys do. It's like if I want my caps bigger, you sculpt them no different like than a sculptor would. I mean, there's certain exercises you do and you guys know what to do. So that's a creative thing. You know, how you pose is a very creative thing. I mean, are you a robot? Are you a blockhead or do you have some grace in your transitions, you know? So it's all, you know, it's all subjective too. But yeah, I probably shot as a serious hobbyist after I retired from Indy. So that was in 99. So for the next 5 years, I was like a serious hobbyist, meaning I wasn't making a living doing it. there were jobs I was getting paid, but you know, nothing like this is a full-time job for me.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2004, I was like, I don't want to do what I'm doing. Cause I was owner operator of a golf course in Canada, with some family, and I wasn't miserable, but I was like, I mean, I'm good. I'm not miserable, but my blood's not screaming.
Right.
And if my blood's not screaming, I'm not good with it.
Right.
And so I was like, I asked myself, took the pad of paper out, sat at the kitchen table. I remember it was like 1 a.m. and I was like, if I could do anything I want to do in life, and what would it be and where would it be?
Right.
And it was definitely photography, and it was going to be either Arizona, Nevada, Southern Cal, or Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And Southern Cal was like too many different people. Utah is one of the hidden gems as far as landscapes go in the country, just stunning. But I just didn't feel like Utah would be the place. And, you know, Nevada, I was like, you know, even though I've got a strong foundation and I'm sober and everything, it's like Vegas is probably not the best place to be, even though I don't have to live, you know, probably not the healthiest place. Right.
Yeah.
But there's good, you know, meetings there, and there's good sobriety there. There's a lot of sobriety there. But I was like, it seemed like Arizona, Phoenix, the Valley, and Scottsdale fit, you know, even though I'm not like, I bring the bell curve down for Scottsdale.
Don't worry. So do I.
We're working on it, right? We're working on these people. So it's like, you know, I got Ferraris and Mercedes, and I'm there in a jacked up Jeep, right? Yeah. And I love it. But it's so I picked this area and knew nobody. And it was one of those make it happen.
So was it just the desert? Is that what you like, picking all those places? Is this something about the desert that you just...
You know, I vacationed here for 3 years prior to that, but it would be all over those states. But mostly I would base myself in Sedona.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I had a motorhome RV, a big 45-foot RV, and I felt better physically, here because of the drier, less humidity. Well, I always thought I felt better because I was on vacation.
Right.
You know, and then
you're
after
just relaxing.
Right. And then three, you know, I'd go back, and like the next day I'd be back home in Toronto, and I'd be like, you're surrounded by the Great Lakes, and I'd be like, oh my God, my shoulders is like all this and all that. And I'm like, I'm not that miserable. And then I put two and two together, and just did a little bit of research, just was skimming the internet, and like I saw a lot of athletes from all sports retiring, or I don't want to say retiring, but ended up living in Arizona because of the dry humidity, the heat, and it helped their body out. And I was like, that's what's happening. And I knew, I kind of figured that out a year and a half, 2 years before I moved here.
Right.
And then I moved here, and I went, you know, from pretty good, lower mid six figure salary. Mm-hmm. To $35,000 the next year.
Right.
And I was happy.
Yeah.
Because you can't buy that shit. Right.
Yeah.
You know.
I love that you brought up the blood boiling earlier, because it's something that
that was key.
I battle with as you transition, because you realize if this is your person,
mm-hmm.
like for me, vacations drive me crazy. Because I'm not doing anything. Like you're not, you know what I mean? Right. And it's very hard for people to understand. Like a day of vacation is awesome. 4 days is like, get me fucking home. Yeah.
It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time.
I have shit to do. What? I don't know. but so I get that though, because I could see you making great money doing the golf course family thing and being, this sucks.
Yeah.
Because it's not hitting that thing. And I think I do believe that that's something that you're born with or not, because most people be like, that's heaven. You've got the perfect gig. You've got, you know, the money's coming. You set yourself up, and you're like, yeah, I'd like to go back down to 35,000 and grind again.
Right. And I didn't even know.
Pick the hardest industry fucking grind.
And know nobody where I'm going. Right.
Yeah.
It's like no network. But I, it was like, so like I've been, you know, all messed up, drunk. I mean, when I say drunk or like in my addiction and made seven figures a year. And I've been in my addiction and made very little money a year. And I've been sober and made seven figures a year. And I've been sober and made very little money a year. Don't get me wrong. I prefer sober and a lot of money.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, I have to be true to me because I'm the one that has to live with me.
Yep.
And because there's a lot of people that don't live with me. and it's like, no, yeah, I'm not perfect, but you know, I always look at the end of the day, it's like, what did I suck stuff out of life today, or did I put something back in it for right. people or for myself or for all those right. days that I, you know, did it for almost a decade. It was all about, you know, me. You know, what do you want to talk about? Let's talk about my favorite topic, me, right? Yeah. So yeah.
How would you describe your photography now? Like I'm not sure how it started and evolved. What I've seen of your stuff, you take pictures of people almost exclusively. Is that not correct?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Like, would you call them portrait style or what do you call them?
They're mostly, yeah, they're portrait, but they're almost, I'd say 80% of the pictures you see on the website are composites. So yeah. they're multiple pictures or layers put together. So there might be like, I might shoot somebody on a clean, like white wall or gray wall, and then composite a texture in the back and then start color grading it and make it cinematic and moody. But it all comes down to, how do I want it to feel? What emotion do I want it to evoke for me? Mm-hmm. And that comes from your own life, personal experiences, especially the struggles.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
For sure.
So it's, you know, when people say, what's your, you know, style like, you know, I say it's cinematic. I said it's very dramatic.
Yeah, it has a look. Like, your stuff is like, it just fucking boom. Like, I love a lot of your stuff, man.
And that's the, and you guys, you probably, you know, relate to that because the paths have been very similar as far as like the sport that you're in. I always considered myself more of a lifter than a football player. A football right. paid better.
Right,
right,
right. So it was like, I mean, unless
damn,
you're
like in the 6'6",
right, or it's like, unless you're in the top like 3 or 4 or 5 in bodybuilding, like overall in the world, it's like, you know, and then you're going to make your money from sponsorship more than you are from, you know, the event. Mm-hmm. So it's, but lifting was like my medicine.
Right.
You know, even like, you know, no pun intended, but lifting was my medicine sober. I mean, I would get all my, you know, stresses and anxieties out. And I loved it when I'd see like a 25-year-old cocky little guy walk up, and, or could have been a semi-big guy walk up and start doing curls with some dumbbells of 80 pounds or something. And I'd be like, fuck this shit. I'd grab the 140s and start slinging them. And I'd be like, I don't care about form. I'm talking about moving weight. What, when we get in a fight, are we looking at form? You know?
Right. You had that mentality.
Pure violence. Right.
It was like, and then I had to be like, whoa, stop in my head. Like, where are you going? You're going to hurt yourself.
Right.
You know, it's like, this is detrimental to myself, but it's that competitive nature. And, you know, I met Dusty, like, and I met Dusty, but didn't really meet him probably over 12, 13 years ago.
Yep.
And Dusty was like, you could tell Dusty was different. Like, he was already jacked up. His traps were hitting his earlobes and shit
different
already.
Is the perfect word.
And
see, I was going for.
and I was like, you know, yeah, I can tell, like, this guy's, you know, don't fuck with this guy. Right. It's like, he was like, I could tell he was serious about what he did.
Yeah.
Because you can just tell. If you were serious about it,
see yourself in something.
Exactly. And I was like, he does stuff that is no bullshit, no nonsense. And he's, you know, and he just does it. He does the work. And then, you know, over time, watching him grow and then become a pro and all this thing, it's like, to me, it's like, listen, the pro thing is impressive. But to me, the evolution of what you have become and the brand you are making is more impressive to me, because people don't, you know, I shouldn't say this about any sponsor, but people don't follow people because of sponsors, or people don't follow people because they work for Merrill Lynch, or if my money's with a guy at Merrill Lynch and he leaves to Morgan Stanley, my money's going with the guy to Morgan Stanley because I trust him. I don't trust Merrill Lynch.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
So there, it's like you guys are the guys that your clients trust wherever you go or whoever you get sponsored by.
Yep.
So it's that relationship. And I think that's so, like, building that rapport, it's so fundamental. And to humanize yourself, I think, blows people away to be like, yeah, I mean, I got the same problems you do.
Was there any, like, you've always been, as far as I know, very open about all this. I mean, you know, everything we just discussed, you've already talked about, you know, drug addiction and, you know, getting, you know, losing the NFL and all that stuff. Did you have to make a decision, or did that come naturally that you were going to be just open and honest about everything? Did you need to do it? Did you feel like you had to do it?
I didn't feel like I had to. I felt like, my motivation was to write a book as soon as I retired from Indy in 98. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of writing the book was to let people know the real story. Because everybody blamed the Green Bay years on steroids. Right. And, you know, steroids were one spoke in the wheel of many spokes.
Right.
And,
right.
And so it was like, look, if you can bench almost 600 pounds and you lose 10%, 15% of your strength, you're still pretty damn strong.
Right.
You know, it doesn't change you totally as a football player like I did. I mean, I fell on my face like a train wreck.
Right.
Because that addiction just took over of the chemical. So I didn't feel like I needed to write it for any other reason than letting people know what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of making it as right as possible. And that was really it. And I had two huge publishers that I went to, that I approached, that everybody would know their names. And I won't say their initials, Penguin or Simon & Schuster.
Right, right.
But they basically said, or whoever was working for them had basically said to me, okay, this is going to be great. You know, you just retired, come back, all this drugs, yada, yada. But we got to name names because it's going to sell more. And I said, okay, well, I'm not into writing the book to get rich. I said, right. I'm in it to help. At the end of the day, even a soccer mom could read it and be like, look, you don't have to play pro football to be a drug addict.
Right.
Or an active alcoholic. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So they said, well, then, you know, we're not interested. And I said, see ya. And I didn't write the book until 2009, almost 9-10 years later. And I went with a tier two publisher who was great. So the biggest thing was he did all like the formatting and everything and printing of the book. We got it on Amazon and some bookstores, and I didn't have to pay for any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't throw anybody under the bus because I think those people should be tortured that throw people under the bus.
Yeah.
And I was like, at the end of the day, this has to help somebody. Like, this has to have the potential that if somebody reads it and they say, if he can do it, there's no reason why I can't do it.
Right.
That's right. Awesome.
And that was the motivation. And
what's your book called?
It's called My Dirty Little Secrets.
It's
called My Dirty Little Secrets, and the subtitle is Steroids, Alcohol, and God. And you know, I was debating on putting the word God in there because it scares people, but, you know, or I was debating on putting in like the human spirit or something. But I was like, fuck it, man. I was like, you know, I don't care what people, I mean, it's like, I'm not a Bible thumper. I'm not like, you got to believe what I got to believe, but.
Right.
I think people know what I meant. Like, whatever
you thought it was belief, appropriate.
Yeah. I was like, you know what? It's my story. I get to, you know, tell them the truth about my story.
Yeah. No, I like that. I think that's like, someone says Merry Christmas. Like, it covers all of them to me.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Like,
yes.
Like, I don't look at them and say, well, you know, I'm whatever. If I was right. another religion,
right, right, right.
I got you. Right. High five.
It's like, I get it. Right. It's
yeah,
like,
thank
I get
you.
It. Yeah.
You too.
So what's the latest project? Like, where do you see yourself taking your art now? And where do you see yourself headed?
There's, I do a lot of personal projects, or what I call self assignments. And those self assignments have gotten me, once I post them, and it could be one image, it could be a series of images. Once I post them and just write my one or two lines about them, I get more business from self-assignments than I do from like regular paid clientele, because like I do headshots, mm-hmm. right? Well, headshots, I mean, yeah, there's certain kind of thing that you have the guidelines you kind of should follow, but then it also depends on, okay, are you a medical company? Are you a, you know, real trendy company that's, you know, cutting edge with internet marketing? Because the headshots will fundamentally be the same, but they're going to be different also. They're not going to be like IBM's headshots.
Right.
Or like corporate, you know, like big corporate America. So like I do a lot of that stuff and it pays good money, but I don't advertise it because I don't want to attract that business.
Right.
Right. Right. I want to attract the business that I post.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a niche. It's a very small niche. So, you know, so a lot of that's, you know, driven and I shouldn't say in the middle of a big project now, but Seven Deadly Sins and Seven Cardinal Virtues. Mm-hmm. And
okay.
And I've done four of them already. And I've had a little bit of a lull. You know, my mom ended up dying 3 years ago, and it really, you know what, as foundationally sound as I was, it derailed me.
Right.
And it surprised me that it derailed me as much as it did, because, you know, she died of Alzheimer's, and it's kind of like we knew she was going to pass eventually. So 14 years she was with it, and then it came down to that 90 days where you kind of know what's going to happen. And then you kind of go into go mode of, okay, look, we got to do this, 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 and this.
Yeah.
And then I'm up there in Canada, and then I fly back here to Arizona, and then the next day I'm shooting MPC stuff in Tucson, and then like a week later, it kind of like makes you go, oh, like really, there's nobody back home.
Right. Yeah. It hit.
I mean, there are a lot of people back home that are related, but mom's not there.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like, and you know what, that, you know, I've talked about that a few times. Publicly, but it derailed me. It put me in about a 9-month like dark side that's not good.
Right.
Like I could put on the happy face walking outside that door.
Right.
But as soon as that door closed, fucking blinds were coming down, and I was like, just like, I fucking hate people, and I hate this, and I hate, you know, and it's like, you know what? That's the truth. A lot of people won't say that.
Right.
Because they're like, oh, you know, I thought, you know, you're sober, everything's great. It's like, no, life still happens. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and I always knew in every adversity, there's a lesson. And the bigger the adversity, the better the lesson. But I couldn't, even in the middle of it, like I was having a hard time. Think about this. Here I am like, so she died July 4th. This July 4th will be 3 full years. Like it'll be the 3 years that she died. I had a hard time like getting out of bed to just like, as far as like motivated to walk.
Right.
Like there was nothing wrong with me. I just like was like, and I was like, you know, all right, this will pass in a week or two. And that sucker lasted like 6-9 months. And again, I can be a good actor and put on a happy face, but my like real, real close friends, which are very, very few, they call my shit right away.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
They can see it. Like they just know. But it was I knew there was a lesson, and I was like, I don't know what the frick the lesson is in this. And but it'll show up months from now or years from now. I'll reflect back on it and I'll be like, that was the lesson. Mm-hmm. And one day I was editing a picture. It had nothing to do with family. It had nothing to do with my mom. I wasn't even talking about family or my mom in date. Like it could have been days or weeks. And just out of the blue, it hits me. And it's like, well, where'd that come from? And then the lesson was, Not once during that 9 months did I think about numbing myself with chemical or drinking.
Right.
And I was like, so for me, that is a miracle, because that's the first thing I would reach for.
Of course.
To numb right. myself, right? And that's like a lot of the things, like if like people reach for to take the edge off that are not alcoholics, and that's okay. And I wish I could do that, but I can't, because the first one, the first drink I take, I'm thinking about the 10th one already.
Yeah, it's the domino. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, that was the lesson. It was like, you've banked enough insurance, and you've gone to so many meetings, and you talk to people in recovery every day. But, you know, at about the 7 or 8 year mark of being sober, I also was like, you know, this isn't limited to people that aren't alcoholics. It's like, this is just right living. Right. Yeah. So it's like, I wanted to surround myself with people that just live right. They don't have to be recovering alcoholics too. You know, right. So, I mean, a lot of my, you know, best friends have nothing to do with 12-step program or never had a drug problem.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, that was the lesson that, and I was like, God, you know, to a lot of people that would be like a small lesson, but for me, it was like, be grateful.
Yeah.
Sure. It never even crossed my mind. I didn't even think about it.
Right.
Yeah. So you definitely had fixed something.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's like, you know, they talk about it's a daily reprieve, you know?
Yeah.
When I get up in the morning, I hit my knees and ask for help, you know, and I say, you know, I can't do it myself. I tried hundreds of times, and every time was an epic failure. And but then when I get up off my knees, I'm like, let's go kick some ass.
Right.
That's how I talk to my God.
Right. Yeah, it's
Why should I talk to him differently?
Right.
It's like, he understands, right? It's like, you know, my God used to be 5'11 and blonde.
Right.
And female, right?
Right. Dusty's is brunette.
And she almost killed me, right?
Oh, man.
But that was a long time ago.
I realize we've had you on a long time, Tony. This might be one of your longest interviews on the internet. We really appreciate having you on. It's been an awesome break for me, and you know, like I knew who you were when I was a kid, even, you know, long before high school. I played high school football too. I knew who you were the whole time. So it's just kind of funny how things come full circle. Yeah. Wind up chatting with you on the show.
Yeah, and it's a privilege. I'm honored that Dusty and you asked me on the show. It's a privilege. It's fun to be on a show that is, because I, you know, a lot of the shows are strictly about football or strictly about sobriety or strictly about addiction, and it's like, I still love doing those, but it was like, this is cool, freaking lifting.
Yeah,
you know?
What you also do
right.
Yeah, we get crazy feedback from some of the shows, and I'm sure there's gonna be a lot of people that I mean, we're amazed by what people get out of it. Like people say, oh, your guest like really helped me make a decision, or your guest really cleared something up for me. Like, it's really interesting. So I can't imagine this one not helping someone.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah.
Anybody can do anything. They just got to give themselves permission.
Well, it helps if they're 13 and a half pounds when they're born too.
But it was a lean
13 pounds.
It was a lean 13 pounds. Hey, so just to end on this note, the day I was born, my mom was mixing concrete with a shovel, sand, gravel, and concrete, cement with water in this bin, because my dad was laying down that was a dirt floor, making it a cement floor in the basement. And she's like, I think my water broke.
Oh, man.
And I'm thinking to myself, talk about being born into blue collar, right?
Yes.
And I'm like, great. Yeah, I'm so grateful.
And he's like, well, hurry up and get this finished. We can't have it dry in the wheelbarrow.
Yeah. My dad's like, can you call somebody?
While you're at it, go grab the sheep.
Right. Exactly.
Thanks. Exactly.
So awesome.
Guys, thanks so much.
Appreciate it, Tony.
Anytime.
Great talking to you guys.
See you.
See you.
Oh, good stuff.
That was fun.
Heck yeah.
The one thing we never asked him about, but you can find some stuff on the internet about it, but there was like a point when he got drafted where he was like talking about fighting Mike Tyson.
Yeah, I saw that.
Letterman even asked him about it. Letterman's like, so what, are you going to fight Mike Tyson? And he's like, I'll fight him. They offer me $10 million. I might fight him, you know?
For $10 million, I'll get my ass kicked by anybody, Ron. I don't mind.
I'm sure his NFL contract had something to do with, yeah, I don't think they let you just get in the ring with Tyson.
Sure, go ahead. We've got $4 million into you already. Why not?
Yeah, there's some contracts that won't even let you ride motorcycles and stuff like that, right?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Yeah. So, no, that was cool to have him on. Quite the story, you know?
Yeah, no, I love that, you know, and he hit it so quickly was the back to basics, because that ties into what we push all the time.
Yeah, that was really obvious when he brought that up, like going back to fundamentals.
Yeah.
And then the other really big part that reminded me of all this is when he said he stood in front of the mirror and he goes, why are you here?
Yep.
And I tell people to ask themselves that when they're in the gym. Why are you here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of good reasons to be here, right? But just make sure you know what your reasons are, and then, you know, don't force something that isn't happening.
Yeah. I mean, you know? Your why drives everything. That makes the things that are impossible, not impossible. I mean, you know, think about when you love something the way you love bodybuilding, it was difficult to do everything you've done your entire career. But it was never hard to do, because it was just what needed to be done to do what you love to do. Like, you know, when you tell an average person about your prep, they're like, I could never do that, because they don't want to. Like, they don't have that why. That, you know what I mean? Why are they there? They're like, I'm here because I don't want to go home for an extra hour. My kids are there screaming. That's why I go to the gym, or that's why I golf.
Yeah.
To avoid my house.
Yeah, I hope everyone goes and checks out his stuff. His Instagram's just at Tony Mandrich, right?
Yep.
Yeah, yep. And he's got a lot of cool shots on there. He does some really, I mean, he's done some great stuff for you, but I've also been on his website, and there's some like really artsy stuff up there.
Yeah, he does really over-the-top stuff, which is cool. I think what I like, so the cable crossover picture that I posted in mine today, I push people back to that picture with him often, because to me it shows his true talent. Because we didn't have lighting. He had a camera, and that was the gym lighting.
Yeah.
So he was able to capture that. And what we literally did is I said, hey, Tony, I'm going to train. You take pictures. So I like to use that to remind people that, like, his raw talent is that good to grab that picture. So if he grabs that and then combines that with his artistic side, what you're going to come up with is insanity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, some really cool stuff. I mean, yeah. He mentioned that he does like the really, really good headshots for people, but that's just like, sounds like it's just something that pays the bills on the regular, because the artsy stuff that I'm thinking of, you scroll down his Instagram a ways and you'll see it. And then obviously on his website and stuff. And that's really cool shit.
Yep.
So that was good, man. I got to piss.
Shocking. You know what that means? We got to be done now. Sherrod's got to piss.
We got to be done now. That was a long show, and I got to wrap it up.
All right. Until next week.
I do the full liter mutant shaker every show.
Well, that's why you have to piss.
Big Ron 20.
Dusty 20.
Dusty 20. IamMutant.com. Use the codes. Get the shit. Okay. That was episode 46, man.
Yes, it was.
Let's do just you and me next week, and I got a shit ton of questions.
So do I. So, yeah, we're going to be busy.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Like, share, subscribe, comment, and remember, it's just bodybuilding.